Hello everyone, and welcome to the Indian Conflict Resolution Podcast, hosted by the Online Indian Journal of Peace and Conflict Resolution. The aim of the podcast is to consult experts and conduct dialogue around conflict and political issues in South Asia and provide our listeners with diverging opinions and accurate information. My name is Madhul Sharma, and I will be your host for the day. Our guest of honor for today's episode is Mr. Robert Cliver, who spent more than a decade in Afghanistan, Pakistan, Central Asia, and in the Middle East, working for the United Nations, the Open Society Institute, and as a freelancer. He specializes in understanding social transformation through conflict, with a double focus on international politics and local cultural development. Since 2010, Mr. Cliver has also been teaching at Sciences Po, or the Paris School of International Affairs, and Mr. Cliver is also pursuing his PhD at Sciences Po on failed state building in Somalia. So today, Mr. Cliver will talk to us not only about the current political situation in Afghanistan, but will also share stories of his time on ground as a UN official. Welcome, sir. How are you doing today, and where are you talking to us from?
Hello, Madhul. Thank you very much for this invitation. I'm doing very well. I'm in Brussels now, where I live, and it's a cold and rainy day here, dreary weather. I hope it's better. Are you in New Delhi?
No, I'm not. I'm actually in a very small town called Dehradun, but I'm happy to talk to you again. For those of you who don't know, which is all of you, Mr. Cliver was also my professor at Sciences Po, where he teaches, like I mentioned earlier. And I personally loved his stories, and I'm very excited to be interviewing him today. But, sir, before we get into the current political state of Afghanistan, I would love to know more about your personal experiences on the ground almost 20 years ago. When and for how long were you in Afghanistan, and what was your experience when organizing local elections in the southwest of the country?
Okay, well, I will have to be careful with this question because I could easily speak for 40 minutes on this point alone. So, because I spent 7 years in Afghanistan, and they were among the most eventful and insightful years of my life. So I had like many adventures and experiences in Afghanistan. I started in March 2000, when the previous Taliban were still in power, working on a cultural heritage project, which was, I mean, the whole point was to defend Afghan cultural heritage and to see what could be done to save whatever was left of it after 21 years of war already then. But then I went on to work with the United Nations. I joined the United Nations in the summer of 2001, and I was actually in Kabul on September 11th when the attack on the World Trade Center happened. I was civil affairs officer then. I rapidly became political affairs officer, and so I had the privilege of experiencing this whole transition from the previous Taliban government to the new internationally supported government from the position of this United Nations political affairs, which was extremely interesting.
Right.
And then afterwards, I quit the UN because I disagreed with their policies. We were a group of political affairs officers who had a little bit rebelled against the United Nations policies, and we all lost our jobs pretty quickly. And then I set out on my own to set up a Foundation for Culture and Civil Society, an Afghan organization. I speak Dari, which is the main language of Afghanistan, fluently. I'd learned it actually in the first year. Mm-hmm. And so I could set up, I worked on the promotion of Afghan culture for many years. I brought Afghanistan to the first Venice Biennial in 2005. But especially, I think we had a lot of activities in our cultural center in Kabul, and also we set up small cultural offices in 7 or 8 provincial towns in Afghanistan. And since then, I've remained involved with Afghanistan. I have so many friends there. So when in August 2021, when the government fell, I also was involved with helping a few of my old friends out of Afghanistan. Mm-hmm. And I've also, on the other hand, I've also been in touch with Afghans who stayed in Afghanistan. over these past 2 years. So yeah, it's a long experience really. Yeah? And I've never actually forgotten to speak Dari, although I've moved on to other areas of interest since then.
Right. And I'm sure, like, you know, knowing the language was also helpful when you were, you know, organizing elections and things like that.
Yes, you asked about organizing elections. Indeed, so the UN team, you know, the United Nations has this issue. They have an extremely slow human resources department. Mm-hmm. So what happened after September 11, 2001, was that it took the United Nations, they immediately realized they were going to scale up their intervention in Afghanistan. But it took them about 8 or 9 months to get to recruit the first people. So we actually managed this whole process of transition with a very small team of United Nations civil and political affairs officers who were already there then, yeah, working for the UN mission. So the elections, yes, we kind of basically, it was pretty amazing how we organized those elections with an Afghan secretariat, obviously. I was responsible for elections in the whole southwest of Afghanistan, so the region of Kandahar, Helmand, Uruzgan, Zabul, mm-hmm. which is considered the most difficult area of Afghanistan because of the Taliban presence. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and those elections, what happened was that we saw that there was this enormous desire of the Afghan people to end the war and to create peace and to get to an understanding with each other. However, there was something happening at the same time. The United States had started a war on terror, and it was extremely important for them psychologically, I would say, to identify terrorists in Afghanistan and to go out and kill them.
Yeah.
So that interfered very much with the process, because there was no, like, the Taliban, who had been in power until 2001, they melted away, but then they came back individually, also to us, UN political affairs officers, saying, hey, we gave up the fight. Can we just, like, live peacefully? We don't even need to be part of the new government, mm-hmm. but as long as we can just, like, stay here and live peacefully, we're okay.
Right.
But then that was not impossible, because the United Nations wanted to hunt them down and kill them. Mm-hmm. And so that actually kind of rekindled a new cycle of conflict. And that was very dramatic to see, like, this very strong desire of the Afghans for peace, and how actually through foreign policies, it was actually sabotaged and undermined. And this whole new cycle started, which led to what happened in August 2021, again, the takeover of government by the Taliban.
Yeah, and, you know, on that note, like, you know, now that the takeover is official again, all over again, what do you think is the best way for the international community to engage with them this time around, given that state intervention has failed the Afghan people before?
Well, I think the international community should simply accept that the Taliban are now the authorities in Afghanistan. Mm-hmm. And yes, they have established a legal regime, which we might not agree with, but, you know, they are the authorities. So there's this strange kind of transfer of, like, what constitutes the legitimacy of a government. It used to be that their own population would constitute the basis for the legitimacy and also the sovereignty of the authorities. However, now it's like this legitimacy is only conferred by the international community, which makes it very difficult, because so since we don't recognize the values on which the Taliban have based their new government, we can't actually engage with them. Yeah, well, we should just be more realistic and pragmatic and say, okay, they are the government in the country, and if the Afghans don't agree with the Taliban government, then let them change it. Yeah, it's not up to us. Of course, we can help, but we cannot, like, decide for them and say, no, that Taliban government is not legitimate. We cannot work with them, because that brings us nowhere.
Yeah, I think that's really fair. But, you know, in terms of working with them, how do you think that we can, you know, and what can the global community do for women in Afghanistan right now? Because, you know, it is hard to work with a government like that. And, you know, so far, it's been kind of tough. So what are your thoughts on that?
Well, working with doesn't necessarily mean supporting. You know, it's like, I know, like if you live in a street and you have like bad relations with your neighbors, but still you work with them maybe to kind of create something of a common interest, it doesn't mean you necessarily support them. On the issue of women, I think actually you addressed that question very well in your previous post on this online Indian journal for peace and conflict resolution, the other one that you posted a few weeks ago, where you actually explain how the approach that was followed by the international community between 2001 and 2021 was ultimately counterproductive and even actually paternalistic. So this whole idea of like what Gayatri Spivak called the white men saving brown women from brown men syndrome.
Yeah.
That has really played very strongly in Afghanistan. And neither the Afghan women actually want it or the Afghan men. So I mean, that's just something we should stop doing. Yeah, I mean, I'm saying we because I'm, of course, myself also a white man. But the international community, I don't think they really have a role actually in dealing with like relations between genders in Afghan society. So, you know, the women, the Afghan women are quite strong. There is actually still some space for them. For example, a friend of mine has Afghan women radio in Kabul. She set it up and still supporting it. It's called Radio Begum. Like, I think you recognize that word. Mm-hmm. But Radio Begum is still functioning. Yeah. So it's actually not that the Taliban have a pure hostility towards the women of their country and are trying to oppress them in any way possible. They just have like this idea of like, we want different values than those of the international community. And within that system, yeah. So again, I think we can still support initiatives by Afghan women without trying to direct them, yeah, and trying to, which is also counterproductive, because when we actually start supporting an Afghan women's initiative, then already it becomes suspect immediately for the Taliban. They say, oh, fine. So again, the Western powers have found a way to kind of interfere in our society. So they close down that initiative. Well, if we were more kind of careful about it and would support it in more discreet ways or less overbearing, then it could have a better effect.
I think that is definitely like an interesting take, because I know, especially like young or like radical people can get a little bit like riled up without actually thinking about what the consequences could be for the women on ground, you know. So I think that's definitely that's a very interesting point. But, you know, on the other side of this acceptance, what state building activities do you think should be carried out by the Taliban leadership this time around that they didn't do earlier? Or, you know, something along those lines.
Well, that's a interesting question. But yeah, I mean, it's a little bit frustrating because the way that... So I'm part of the international community. Yeah, I mean, I can say I've been like involved in these kind of state building activities or humanitarian or development activities, not only in Afghanistan, but also in many other developing countries and especially post-conflict situations. But we've kind of... So yeah, the question is good, but it's very difficult to think about it, because the way we keep thinking about it is always like what we do, yeah? So if I would just position myself, as a Taliban advisor, which is obviously a bit difficult, then I would think that like the first thing they have to do obviously is work on the economy, because the Afghan economy was completely artificial in all these years of intervention. The everything, the prices, the wages, the prices of things were incredibly inflated because of the enormous inflow of foreign funding. So that economy basically has that inflated economy has now collapsed. We all thought back at the end of 2021, after the Taliban takeover, everybody seemed to think that the Taliban, that the Afghan economy would collapse entirely, and that there would be like a terrible famine, and also considering that there have been years of drought and low agricultural yields. In fact, that didn't happen. So in that sense, we have to give some credit already to the authorities for having like at least found ways to make the economy work I don't know exactly how they made it work, but it seems to have worked. At least the markets still seem to be full of products. People are poor, mm-hmm. but there is food is available, yeah, and heating and housing. So, I would say their first priority should be like build a new economy, which is based on self-sufficiency. Afghanistan was self-sufficient in the past. It had it has enough agricultural potential to feed its own population. Besides, obviously, it has a lot of minerals and it has other wealth that it could export. Mm-hmm. That would be like number one. I think another very important in terms of state building, what the Taliban should focus on is the local dimension of state building. So creating, because Afghanistan is a very diverse country, like the population of Herat, for example, in Western Afghanistan, which is very much exposed to Iran, and that of like Southwest Afghanistan, which is neighboring, but which is much more influenced by Pakistan and Balochistan. They're two very different kind of populations. So you can't like have one kind of measure for all. So I think that they should really work on local government capacity building, and also integrating the population that has remained, because of course a lot of experts and specialists have left the country, have fled. Mm-hmm. But those that remain, they're desperately needed to run the country, and to run the economy, to run the machinery of government, and also the machinery of the economy. So the best way to integrate them, I think, would be at the local level, not because the Taliban at the national level, they're just really not supported by a lot of the Afghan people. So it's difficult for them to work at that level. So those are two issues which I think they should focus on.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And how do you think the UN can play an effective role, or do you think that the UN should play a role at all in this, reconstruction or in, peace building activities in Afghanistan for the future?
Well, I worked for the United Nations directly mm-hmm. for years, and also indirectly. And I really think that the United Nations is the main vector of this kind of imposition of a social political model upon all countries in the world. It's not the only one, it's not the most powerful one, but it's maybe like the most kind of legally constructed organization. And so I cannot see the United Nations actually being flexible enough to deal with local realities. Instead of imposing a certain kind of social political system which has been dreamed up in San Francisco back in 1945, and which has developed since then, of course, a lot, but which is still extremely kind of a Western-dominated system, dominated by the great powers that still have a seat in the Security Council. So I really cannot really see a role for the UN. Now, maybe like something, organizations like the UN Development Program, or the High Commissioner for Refugees, they could play a role, but even those organizations are very ideologically kind of constituted, I would say. So it's difficult to see how they will be able to get along with the Taliban. So my advice would be like maybe just to withdraw the United Nations entirely from Afghanistan, and to replace it with bilateral missions. For example, a few countries have already been doing that. Yeah, like China has obviously its own kind of bilateral approach to Afghanistan. So a lot of the countries which don't find themselves or cannot express themselves through the United Nations have like developed their own kind of policies. And I think it would be much more interesting to continue with those. India also, by the way.
Yeah. Actually, in terms of like bilateral relations and things like that, do you think that the current geopolitical state of the world, with the war in Ukraine, which is almost like now a year long, do you think that's taking away some of the attention deserved by, or, something that could have changed anything about the Taliban takeover of Afghanistan this time around? Or, for example, in terms of women, as we were talking before, do you think that if Afghanistan had its fair share of attention or of resources, things could have been different?
Well, Madhul, you see that Afghanistan had its fair share of attention. Yeah, for 20 years, there was a lot of attention on Afghanistan. Okay, it was dwindling a little bit towards the end, but like still, there was always a lot of interest in Afghanistan. I don't think that that interest in Afghanistan has really helped Afghanistan that much. Maybe in some ways it has, but in many other ways it didn't really help. So I'm not even sure that like the fact that Ukraine is distracting the attention away from Afghanistan, that it has a negative impact on Afghanistan or even on the people of Afghanistan or even on the women of Afghanistan. So as I just mentioned, like as soon as we get like all worked up about women in Afghanistan, the result is that the Taliban think, okay, here we go again. They're again like interfering in our social relations, in our culture, and so we're going to close down these women's organizations that are receiving support from the international community. So yeah, and in that sense, bilateral relations have a much bigger chance of helping. You know, of like for example, if a women's organization from Emirates, for example, is like interested in helping Afghan women develop, for example, their business opportunities. That's the kind of support which will not like trigger the Taliban into closing down programs.
You know, for my last question, I just wanted to ask you something a little bit off the political side of things. But I know you're also a cultural connoisseur. I also know, you know, you were just talking about the Venice Biennale. I would love to know your thoughts on, you know, destructive cultural practices of the Taliban in the past. And do you think this time will be any different, and how?
Yeah, that's a really good question, because obviously that's main. I would say that for most of the Afghans that I know, it's the cultural practices of the Taliban which are most repellent. Which back then, back in 2000, when I was there the first time, and again now, this idea of like prohibiting music and just enjoyment, of their own culture. That's really what triggers Afghans to hate the Taliban and to see them also as a foreign imposition force, as if they were like some, the conquest of Afghanistan by Islam in the 8th century, I think it was, was like a moment that Afghanistan suddenly fell deep into a kind of a rabbit hole. And only emerged somewhere like around the 13th century again, after the invasions by Genghis Khan and their destruction. So 100 years after that, then again, Afghanistan grew. So there's something which is not really compatible about this version of extreme, rigid Islam, which comes from the Arabian desert and the Afghan temperament, I would say. So yeah, there's a really difficult issue. So I think there has been some difference already. The Taliban have not been quite so radical as in the past. Like, for example, I had a friend who was traveling through Kabul, and like actually not only Kabul, but through Afghanistan recently. And she was posting all these pictures on Facebook of like girls and young women walking on the street without any headdress. So it doesn't seem that they're like so... they're not so rigid anymore.
Well, that is very interesting, and I think that only bodes well for the future. I think you've given us a lot to think about. Thank you for your stories and your opinions today. Your insights are truly valuable, and I'm sure will be beneficial to our audience. For more information, you can visit Mr. Cliver's website, robertk.space, and you can find more pictures of his time in Afghanistan and can read more about his work. You can also join us next month for our next episode, where we will bring you more interesting speakers on issues that concern our subcontinent and security issues in general. Thank you for joining us today. Please visit our website for more information on what we do. Feel free to write to us or for us. We look forward to hearing from you. Thank you once again, Dr. Cliver, and talk to you all again very soon.